Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. It's occurred to me with Simon Le Bon that there's a lot of cross-referencing that our listeners can do by listening to other episodes of our podcast.
Yeah, and in fact, if we'd been clever, we could have thought about that before and sort of put in lots of little Easter eggs, but I know I haven't.
Little clips, you mean?
So, you're right. There are things we can draw on from what John said.
I think it's better if people go back and compare and contrast. You know, it was a bit like when we had Kurt on one week, and you know, Ronan on the another week. But so we've had John Taylor on before, which I re-listened to actually just this morning, which was I thought John was very erudite. It'd be interesting.
John was incredibly erudite. Well, of course he was. He's the bass player.
And of course we had the new guitarist on a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. Yeah, we did. Yeah, who I must say, I've been really enjoying the new album. He certainly did bring something to the party. But we'll obviously talk about that.
I can't remember his fucking name. Tell me his name.
Zeppo, Graham Coxon.
Right. Okay. I'll edit this in.
Leave that in.
I'll edit this in. Of course, we're talking about Graham Coxon.
Of course we are.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I want to know from Simon's point of view what it was like getting Graham, you know, a 90s icon to come in and play on his record.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to talk about.
There really is. And don't forget, it's another Spandau Duran face-off.
We're going to keep getting Duran members on until I get the punch up I so desire.
So we may have to mention that episode of Pop Quiz.
Oh, yes.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Simon. Hi, fellas. Apologies for being so late, but it was a late call. I had to go and pick up my grandson from school.
No problem. Oh. How sweet.
What a good and considerate grandfather you are, Simon.
I am. Very good and considerate.
Oh, and you've got a nice microphone there, and it looks very pro.
I have, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I've got a radio show.
Yeah,
I've got a radio
ask you
show.
About that. Whoosh.
So I do, like, exactly. Yeah.
Where is it? It's on Sirius.
It's Sirius XM. It's an hour show every week. It's all new music, actually. All new. I like alternative bands, I like alternative artists, a little bit of R&B and stuff as well. But lots of great stuff. You know bands like Dry Cleaning?
No.
No.
You know, but do you know about Dry Cleaning?
No, I don't know. No,
oh,
I know
God,
about Dry
check
Cleaning.
Check out Dry Cleaning. They're an amazing band, spoken word artist. Have you heard Idols?
Yes, yes.
Things like, have you heard of Idols?
Yes, Idols have heard.
So it's quite a lot of post-punk or punky stuff. They call it post-punk now, but actually it's punk.
Fontaines from Belfast.
What we are is post-punk.
Yes, exactly. And it's funny, because like on Wikipedia, Duran Duran are down as New Wave, which is a kind of, in America, that's their blanket thing, isn't it?
From anything
that was. But that's good that you get to listen to all new music because of the show.
Yes. Well, I mean, it started off during at the very beginning of lockdown, actually. And then I had a little bit of a sort of a contretemps with my daughter, Tallulah, because I came downstairs and she was listening to Radio 6. I went, oh God, I can't have this one on my breakfast time. I've got to put Radio 4 on.
Sounds like our house.
Quite.
And good. So I changed and she went, Dad, she says, call yourself a musician. You don't even like music. Especially new bands. I thought, wow. I thought, oh God. I thought, and you know what? I thought that thing, you know, when you're in a taxi after the studio, you spent sort of 8 to 12 hours in the studio, 3 if you're me, and you get into the taxi and taxi driver, 4 o'clock in the morning, taxi driver goes, oh, what channel, what music do you want to listen to? And you go, you know what? I just like maybe have a little bit of quiet now. I've been surrounded by music all day long. And that kind of sets in and you end up in a situation where the only music you're listening to is what you're working on currently and what got you into a band in the first place. Yeah. And I thought, she's right. I don't like music. So I made a big effort and started listening to stuff. And at the same time, my mate Nick Wood in Tokyo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Said, you know, Nick Wood, Sin, yeah. Sin Productions, Sin Music. Nick said, we need to do something during COVID. Let's put together a playlist. So I started, I said, that's great because I'm just getting into new music. And then a couple of weeks later, Wendy Laister, our manager, she calls up and she says, oh, we've got to do something, Charlie. We've got, you know, you've got John's doing a bass tutorial. Roger's doing a drum tutorial. Nick's doing his art thing.
Don't smirk, guy.
What can you do? What can you do? And I thought, well, I'm not going to do a vocal tutorial. I said, I'm sorry
to laugh there, but I just imagine people doing that now, can't you? People are so desperate to get on. Mm-hmm.
Having said that, Simon, I've heard your vocal warm up, and it's very, very good. I think that would be very helpful to
my vocal warm up. Do you mean my?
I heard your vocal warm up when we all played together.
Yes,
at that wedding. And
yes,
and you did a really, really good. I remember thinking it wasn't.
Did
like
I have a little? Did I have a little set of ear things in? Because I lost my voice completely and utterly in 2003.
Oh, that's right. You had to cancel the tour, didn't you?
We cancelled the whole tour.
Yeah,
still trying to get the money out of the insurers. And I part of my rehabilitation was going to see a voice therapist who in London called Ruth Epstein. She is amazing. She's this wonderful sort of Eastern European Jewish lady who's very, and she gave me this warm-up session and which I put onto my all of my devices actually, and I stick the earphones in and you know, there's me going, was it sort of and all that
Did you have nodules?
Yeah, there was a bluesy scale thing as well, which was really good. It was really
nice. Well, that's
nice.
Like when I've done the warm up, I just start trying to riff to keep it warm. Riffing on. Yeah, I like that.
Because actually,
I like,
you know, this
is,
Simon, it's interesting because people don't really think, you know, they don't care as much for singers in that, you know, a band says, let's get back together. We haven't played for so many years, you know, it's our 40th anniversary or whatever it might be. And the bass player gets his bass out and finds the riffs again. Same with the guitar player. But the fear that the singer has to find that voice, to sing those songs that he sang and wrote as a young man, that's far more terrifying.
It is. It would be, and it would be particularly so if you hadn't done it for a while. I haven't stopped. I have not stopped at any point. So there's not been a week that's gone by without me singing. And I know that I have to stretch myself. And as we approach, you know, a show when we haven't been on tour for 6 months or sometimes it's longer. Well, it was after lockdown, of course. It was a very long time. You know, I kind of pace myself and I kind of walk. I get myself stronger and stronger. And I don't try and hit the high notes in Wild Boys the beginning of the rehearsal, the beginning of getting ready for it. You know, that's what I'm aiming for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about the new album, because we had Graham Coxon on here this show about 3 weeks ago. Yeah. What a lovely, lovely man he is. And when we you know, said, how come Duran Duran, you know, he just couldn't believe we even had that question. He was so enthusiastic, you know, he was a fan, and he was being asked to play in a posh band.
Yeah,
You know, and I loved it because I watched your bit on the BBC when you did you played together with him. And he actually wore a very posh Duran style jacket for the show, didn't he?
didn't he? Well, he's a smart guy. It was magnificent that he said he'd come and do it, but we had no idea of what we were going to get until he started playing, and that was what really blew our barn doors off.
He did really, really bring. I must say, because loving the album, and he really brought something to the party, didn't he?
I know. I mean, he's got this thing. He doesn't want to play anything that's ever been played before. He's really, he's determined to come up with new riffs and new sounds. And that is the most wonderful thing to have in your creative output, because, you know, and we had to, he raised the game and we had to come up to it. You know what it's like when you're working on music as a band and when you're all trying, you know, you're all kind of writing together. You know, one person takes it up and then somebody else comes up to that level, then somebody else comes and takes it a bit further, and then everybody has to go to
Were you careful?
You
know?
He said about the writing process, he said he was amazed and impressed about how, like, there was literally no avenue left unexplored.
Did he tread carefully in the he didn't want to feel, oh, I'm writing this, that you guys are the composers and I'm just going to find whatever I need to find to suit your song?
I think he started off like that, but I think after a while he just wanted to play the best guitar he could play, and that in its way that was what we really wanted, because and then he became a really full part of the whole writing setup.
Because I actually think he's very similar to Andy in some ways, in that, you know, Andy this very choppy,
well, more brusque
version.
But
Andy had this sort of choppy staccato style that was a combination of Nile and Angus Young, you know, and
exactly. Exactly. But he also had a bit of sort of like, he had a little bit of Jimi Hendrix and a little bit Jimmy Page.
Right. But Graham has that. Yeah. He has that choppy, odd kind of rhythmic thing. And that suits what you do. Because Duran sound has always been trying to fit in electronica with rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the album, Tom, in talking about collaborators, you had some major, I don't know if these are mass box ticks for you, but like Giorgio Moroder and Mike Garson?
Yeah, I mean, those two are ones that we've wanted to have some kind of connection with for years and years and years, but the opportunity just never arose. I mean, I met Mike at a Smashing Pumpkins gig that he did way back, and I went up and sang Nightboat with Billy and the band. So I met Mike at that point, and that was over 20 years ago, and it took this long for it to kind of to fall into place. Giorgio Moroder is somebody we should have worked with years ago, but it just you know, we were just never in the same town and in the same phase of the of our careers.
Yeah, and I mean, he's doing real Giorgio Moroder doing Giorgio Moroder,
it's
spotted from
those guys were both massive influences on us as young men, weren't they? I mean, Giorgio
were.
I can see a lot more in what you did in the 80s, but for me, you know, Garson's piano on that Aladdin Sane album, you know, I'll never forget how that made me feel. I mean, it was one of the most emotional pieces of music I'd ever heard in my life.
Wasn't Love to Love You Baby the first thing that you played at the Rum Runner?
Yeah, I said the very first show that I fronted Duran Duran for on the 16th of July 1980. I still have the ticket.
You had to buy a ticket?
You had to get a ticket? You had to get a ticket?
We had to pay to get it on stage, yeah. But now I kept one. Kept one as a memento. And
that's interesting. Is that because you knew that it was coming and this would be the date?
Well,
tomorrow?
I just like collecting little bits of paper, actually. Generally, fast ticket things. And the the first song that came out of the band with me as a front man was I Feel Love.
I Feel Love. So not Love to Love You, Baby. What the hell
exactly,
am I
thinking? I Feel Love.
Wow. Not I Feel Love, that's what I meant.
Wow. Obviously.
I thought that was a bit weird. I thought, no,
that was
sure
a bit
that
weird, wasn't it?
Not in it?
Yeah, no, yeah. I don't know why I thought that.
Love to Love.
That is amazing.
It's not a million miles away.
Because I'd never realised.
It's so good.
Hey, watch it. You haven't done a warm-up.
The major to minor on that. Oh.
He hasn't done a warm-up yet. Simon, we're going to have to go back to those moments, though, you know, of you joining the band. You know, but before then, let's talk about you growing up. Well, I just mentioned Mike Garson and listening to Aladdin Sane. Right. But what was the music that was turning you on as a kid, first of all?
Well, I mean, the first thing I really got, I mean, I remember hearing She Loves You when I was 5 years old, thinking, oh my God, what's this? Mm. But then I grew up in a house that was really full of classical music. Mm. And I went and performed in festivals, singing festivals and things, competitions. And I did poetry,
was that solo or was that
drama,
choral?
Solo. And then I joined a choir when I was 11. But the thing which grabbed me first was T-Rex.
Yeah.
The song.
Yeah,
Ride
me too.
Me
too.
In fact, that was Tyrannosaurus Rex. They weren't T-Rex at that point. And it was that song. I just loved it. I was crazy about it. And then that kind of, then after that, it was, you know, David Bowie. And David Bowie, I mean, my entry album to David Bowie really was Aladdin Sane, which was the great Mike Garson record. So whenever I think of Mike Garson, I think of diddling ding.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the opening of
Driving
Saturday.
The end of time, is it? Yeah.
Ding, 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 yeah, ding, yeah. Ding, yeah. So I was obsessed with David Bowie. I used to draw pictures of David Bowie on my school exercise books instead of doing the schoolwork I was supposed to do. So I had lots of great pictures of David Bowie wearing his high heel, you know, his platform shoes with the palm trees on, the one with the big kind of sun on the front of his forehead. And then there's and trying to get that kind of that zigzag thing exactly right over the shaved brow. I spent hours and hours and hours doing that. So when it came to physics exams and maths exams and geography, I was thinking, oh, I don't know any of the answers to this stuff. Because what I've been doing, can I just do a bit of spiky orange hair instead?
Yeah. Can I demonstrate Hooke's law using the lightning flash from a
No, that's it, it was he was better with Dr. Hooke's law. I think he could have done probably. But what is it about that about Bowie? In a way, for all of us, it wasn't just the music, was it? There were obviously it was entwined, but it was this otherworldliness. It was this escapism. It was this outrage. It was it was all of the lines that for a pubescent boy were being blurred by this creature, and he was ours. He didn't belong to anyone older than us.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the kind of the alienness of him. He's the spaceman, the alien. It wasn't a sex appeal thing for me, or if it was, I wasn't recognizing it as such. He was one.
And
you met
him, obviously, Simon.
At the time. But yes, I met him a lot because we were on tour together.
That's right. I remember coming to see that in Toronto. That's when you came to see us in Toronto when
that's
we were rehearsing.
Right. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
In 87. Yeah.
And how was that being on tour with David?
It was wonderful, and it was a little bit annoying as well. I mean, it was great because we were on tour with David Bowie. It was supposed to be sort of equal top billing, but you pretty soon realised that it wasn't.
What album?
It was his
the
album.
Glass Spider tour.
The Glass Spider tour.
So that was that the Tonight album?
Well, it was the one after Let's Dance,
Tonight.
Wasn't it? It was 87.
One after the one after.
One after that.
Yeah, which is Never Let Me Down.
People are screaming at their telephones or radios now. Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, But you see, weirdly though, because that, you know, it was a different kind of David Bowie to the one that I was idolizing.
What's what he calls his Phil Collins period, isn't it?
That's very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it was still David Bowie. The thing is that his record company had bought up the first seven rows of every auditorium, and David had a meet and greet while we were on stage. So the first seven rows of all the auditoriums we played were empty. So we had to get over that, which was not so easy. But we hung out with him quite a bit, and you know, he oh God, I remember once we were at the Canal Bar in New York, and we sat down for a dinner. And we're sitting there, and David's sitting next to me, and he got really drunk. And he managed to pour his red wine into my pasta. And I'm like, David. And he goes, what, do you want to fight? Come on, let's have it out. You know, he got all boxy. I think he was sort of starting to get into the boxing.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
And did you?
Outside.
And did you?
No.
No, but you know how times change like that. It's like, when you're young and you join the Labour Party and it's very exciting and different and exotic. And then when you finally get to meet anyone in the Labour Party, it's the Blair years, you know. And that right. Let's Dance is kind of Bowie's Blair years.
Not the Michael Foot years.
But
not the Harold E. Wilson years.
But these are the moments when we pinch ourselves, when we're on par with our heroes. And he would have been looking up to you.
I never thought he would be. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't know. I was so in awe. I was ridiculous.
Did he join you on stage at any point? Did
no.
you do?
No, we didn't do anything together.
Simon, you wanted to be an actor. Was that? Did you want to be an actor? You did drama.
I did. No, I did. I was determined to be an actor. That was the thing that was going on. I studied drama pretty much from the age of 5 until 18. Music started to distract me. And I ended up sort of wanting to go down the pub with my punk mates and sort of missing drama classes. And I got spotted and I got told off, you know. And I thought, I still carried on. But I got, I auditioned for Central School of Drama, and I got rejected after the second round. And I was so shocked by the rejection. I thought I'd breeze it. I did. And then that kind of made me think, well, maybe you're not as good as
you. Do you remember what your audition piece was?
Oh God, no, absolutely. Oh, no, can't remember. I did so many of those things. I went to university. I went to, University of Birmingham and I kept getting shoved out of roles into set design and into wardrobe and you know what I mean? And into sort of,
that wasn't why you were there. Stuff.
I thought, they don't want me to act. Mm. There's me thinking I was sort of like a, you know, Simon Olivia Le Bon. And actually, it was, I was kind of going down a different road. And then I met the band. And suddenly I thought, acting is all this struggle, all this rejection, just to work, do somebody else's words, just to be somebody else that, you know, it's been designed, and you're just serving that. And here's me with my chance to go on stage now with my own script.
No, you're absolutely right, because acting is interpretative. Where what you've done for all of your career is not like at all.
And so, Simon, wait, because there's a thing that John said when we had him on, which is that when you turned up, you had this notebook, you had this book of lyrics, which was just the golden thing. Mm. He said, that's the mother load. That's what everyone in a band is looking for, the bloke with the words, you know.
It's in this room somewhere, but I'd look at it. I'll never find it anywhere.
And is that your accounts behind?
No.
Maybe you hid it when... You hid it when the...
Yasmin's photograph.
Did it get hidden covers. And lost when the Batman came? Is that what happened? In a scurry, in a moment of papers flying?
No, the book is around somewhere. It's in this room. But, I mean, honestly, you just want to see the...
Along with all your bus tickets.
Look at the fucking mess in here. It's just ridiculous.
I can't look at that. My OCD is...
That's good. That's
no,
all.
No, you can't. Don't look at it. Look at your lovely minimal studio with a picture down in the corner and a guitar growing out of your head. I mean, honestly.
Don't he has a Simon? Before we come on, he always has a go at me about my room. I always have to move a couple of things.
That.
It's Mark and Mickey.
Oh wow!
That's the picture in the corner.
Anyway, but you turned up with this book, and you turned up with, is it true, leopard skin trousers?
Yeah, the first time I met the band, I was, well, the second time, it was a pair of faded, they were, originally were kind of maroon leopard skin, maroon oh, with black ones. Leopard yeah, yeah. skin spots on. But they'd actually kind of got washed a few times, and they'd faded to pink.
The introduction was your girlfriend, wasn't it, who was working at the Run Runner, or was it not?
Well, yeah. It was, yes, it was a girl. And it was a girlfriend, who'd moved up to, we'd kind of broken up. We got together, we broke up. Then she came to Birmingham. We lived together there, and then we broke up. And Fiona Kemp, lovely, lovely, lovely girl.
Any relation?
Oh, I haven't
no relation. I don't think.
No, relation. No, I don't think so. No, no, no. So she suddenly turned up at the bedsit that I had in Moseley and said, "I've met this band and they're looking for a singer. I think you should audition for them." And I thought I was going to get a sympathy fuck, but it wasn't to be. And,
well, instead, you had to settle for joining Duran Duran.
I had to settle for joining Duran Duran, yes. And I went along, and it was right. You're right. I met them. We got on. We looked like we could be in the same band because we had the same sort of fashion sense. And I had this big book of lyrics. I mean, with about, you know, 30 songs, 30 bits of writing in there. And that's what they really wanted, because they'd one song that they'd written lyrics to. It was called Secret Success. And they had, but they had some titles like Girls on Film, and all the rest of it sort of just fell into place.
But were these lyrics or poetry?
It was, well, some of it was lyrics, songs that I'd been in the band before. I had two, but the first band I was in, well, actually, the first band, it was called Bolo, as in gatto.
Not Bolo, as in bollocks, then.
Well, exactly. we never played any shows. We just rehearsed a bit. And the second band was called Dog Days, and we played one show. And it was myself, Pete Johns on bass, Olivia Bizzardi, who worked for Sony Music later on drums. Alan St. Clair, who played with Spear of Destiny, he was on guitar. Carol on keyboards.
Carol?
No, I didn't know. I know Carol's surname. It's just gone right out of my head. Carol Isaacs. And me on the microphone. And we rehearsed in Ruislip. And we played one show at Harrow Tech. I was at art school at the time. I was there at Harrow Art School. And we played on the floor, not on the stage, because the main band Supercharge wouldn't let us share their
stage. What, the funk band?
The funk band Supercharge.
Was it Lowell Coxhill? Was a sax player in them? No, I think. Yeah.
I don't know what his name was.
The guy went and played for all the punk bands.
But anyway, we played our support set. We're supposed to be on for half an hour. We went over our deadline. They pulled the plug. We carried on unamplified. With me, all you could hear was me screaming and the drums going. And then we finally stopped. Went right. We're all going down the pub. Half the audience left with us. And as we walked out, we heard the MC go, "Thank you, dog shit."
Dog shit have left.
We had songs like
Was that Bolo featuring dog shit?
Only Room for Robots.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic! Oh, but had you been going to the Rum Runner?
Not at that point. That was before I went to Birmingham. That was when I was about sort of 18. Yeah,
because the Rum Runner was the club. It was the sort of the Bowie Night Blitz club
Yes, it was.
Like the Stringfellows and everything, wasn't it? It was. No. It had a much no, broader
that was
remit,
Liberties.
Didn't it?
No, that oh, was it? Liberties. Oh, okay. You're getting, right. No, it was never like Stringfellows.
Oh, okay. Well, I just thought it was more of a mainstream sort of place, no, which had a cool night.
Well, no, it wasn't. It was a real music place, the Rum Runner. Okay. Was. I mean, there was soul and funk night, and there was what on Friday nights what was called Bowie Roxy night, and that was the New Romantic night, and that was the night that everybody used to come to. That was the night that you guys came to, Gary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was a
Friday
night. You came after the Botanical Gardens show.
That's right.
I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed. I thought it was a fantastic show.
So, because I know you, I didn't really know you guys then, and we'd done Top of the Pops, and we came up with our London entourage and played in Birmingham, yeah. And you know, I think we were quite, you know, we knew there was a big scene up there because there was that There was that scene with Carn and Bell, that shot with Carn and Bell.
Yes, right, Jane Carn and Patty Bell.
Had all their new, you know, wild clothes and stuff. Yeah. And so we knew that we had to go there first, Birmingham. And there was this other band there. And we ended up going back to, I think it might have been Paul Barrow's flat or something.
I think you stayed at Margaret's house.
Really?
Yeah, Margaret was
that sounded so loaded. You stayed at Margaret's house.
That's a great rumour. Okay. Margaret was really, she was the secretary of the Barrow brothers, and she worked in the office at the Rum Runner. I think the story was that all of you guys went and stayed there that night, and somebody had sex with her.
Which
I have to say is perfect. You know, if you're thinking about sort of 20-year-olds in the beginnings of the 80s, it's perfectly normal. You know, there's a single girl and a bunch of guys. One of them's going to have sex with her.
Yeah, but I swear,
it's normal, right?
I ended up on the floor with well, who I think, and I'm sure now because we've had conversations about it, was Nick.
Ended up on the floor. Somebody was on the sofa, and somebody else was in Margaret.
And Nick telling me that you guys had a band, you know, and you were, you know, coming from a similar background. Of course, I thought nothing of it then, not realizing that we would cross each other's paths for the next 10 years at least and more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we didn't, but I think you guys were sort of, I don't know, you guys were kind of, you were a lot more important, and we were determined to be as important as you guys. That's how it felt at the time. So we were determined, and we knew we were going to make it. But I don't think you guys were ever kind of, you know, and in the same way as we would never kind of meet young bands and think, oh, they're going to be big one day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just meet other bands.
You've
got so much on your plate. You don't see any. There's no rivalry. There's none of that stuff going on. It's sort of, it's just, you know, we're all in this, and we're all struggling to keep our heads above the water.
Because exciting. Sorry, guy.
Oh no, well, yeah, it wasn't that important. No, I was just saying, because when you first got together with the lads, you didn't actually have that new romantic thing to hang your hat on, did you? Did you not really?
No.
You were finding what it was going to be.
Absolutely. And we read the article in the NME, and the word and the phrase new romantic was in that article. And I thought, I like that. And I put it into the lyric of Planet Earth.
That's
like
right.
Some new romantic looking for the TV sound. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I did that, it put us into the whole scene.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the rock on tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out.
The TV sound, how prophetic was that? Because this is, you didn't know what was coming around the corner, because the great medium for all of us, which took us all by surprise, was not one of us at that point thought we had to make videos in our career.
Really. Absolutely.
That was all we thought was, for, you know, we're going to talk to journalists, make great records and look good on stage, you know, and what was to come. But I think the excitement of being part of a scene, and that there was rumour, and we already knew of the Human League up in Sheffield and what they were doing, and Simple Minds as well. You know, that's, there was...
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, I often wonder, because there's so many bands who then became part of the same sort of school, but at the time they weren't, because Simple Minds came out of, you know, they started as a punk band, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I think if you go back to the very early, sort of like 1980 and 81, 1980, really. I just think of what was on the dance floor, what music was being played on Roxy Bowie Roxy night, Friday night at the Rum Runner, and it was Bowie, it was Roxy, it was
Kraftwerk, perhaps.
Mick Ronson,
right?
Only after dark, the Passenger, Iggy Pop. You know, Simple Minds.
Is that Travel? Is that the one from Empire and Dance?
No, it's it's called Changeling.
Changeling, yeah.
And then we had then you started to get the sort of the stuff, the new romantic stuff that came from London, like Visage was getting played, You Guys, and Ronnie.
Ronnie, the beautiful tall French model.
She did a cover of If You Want Me to Stay,
yes,
didn't she?
That's right.
If you want me to stay, I'd be around someday.
Because there was this kind of
very, very French, right?
Very, very good French. But
he's right. And I think what turned us onto that kind of feel was Cabaret had come out, the movie Cabaret. I was really reminded of this recently because I went to see the play that's on in London. And how that movie influenced a lot of what we were doing, you know, that sort of Weimar Republic feel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was the line, wasn't it? Something about scanning maps of, somebody said that the new romantics, they'll be there on a Saturday afternoon, running up new pairs of jodhpurs and scanning maps of Germany for sappy song titles.
Yes. When you signed your record deal, EMI, I mean, that was a big one. And you landed that. John told us you landed that with only 7 songs in your armory.
Well, 7 songs ready to record. But there was also the whole album, the whole Rio album that we were playing. We're playing songs that would become.
Oh, you already Rio had those songs.
But we didn't have difficult second album syndrome. We had difficult third album syndrome.
I just wanted to talk about Colin, you know? Thurston.
Oh, right,
who produced that album, and what an important guy he was in the transition between post-punk and the 80s sound, you know, because he did Magazine, hadn't he?
Well, he was the engineer on Station to Station.
Oh, yes.
That's right, yeah. That's what we
were impressed by, and he really was such an important part of our sound. You know, the things he did, like, you know, gated snare drum, and then playing back the snare drum to through a microphone and recording what happens to the snare when you play the actual track back through. It sounds weird, doesn't it? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Little tricks like that, and we did tape phasing. You know, and. All these real old.
It sounds
like
great, that album, though.
I was going to say, I was listening this morning. It stands up so well. I mean, it's really, it's like, it's as exciting as it was then. It's, do you know what I mean? Yeah. It hasn't dulled at all. It's fantastic.
Planet Earth, yeah, absolutely. It was,
yeah.
It's a great garage record, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like one of the, you know, I like to think, to cut long story short, is partly in there, but You Really Got Me, My Generation, I mean, you know, Anarchy in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain songs that define a youth culture. You know, Planet Earth is one of those moments.
I'll take that as a compliment. Not what a nice list to be on.
I'll never forget that closing shot of the video of you jumping off the edge.
Let's talk
and he's gone.
Yeah.
And that's the end of Turning Around.
Well, yeah, for all the flat earthers.
But it is the video, isn't it? The videos of everything. I mean, it's way all of us. I mean, you know, I mentioned this earlier about the surprise that the importance of videos had. And of course, you did this, you had the nerve. And I remember being so jealous that you'd done the Girls on Film with Godley and Craig.
Oh,
we
right.
had Lol on here
a while ago.
How is he?
He was great. He was lovely when we spoke to him.
Oh, good. That was a while back. Good.
Beavering away with Trevor Horn.
Yeah. It's so sweet. They just sit around the studio all day telling each other stories. It's just adorable.
But I mean, let's just talk about that whole MTV thing, because really, you nailed it with MTV.
Right.
And
thank you.
And I think all of us, you know, that was the train that we all had to get on to do well in the States. And what's funny is that MTV comes along in America and decides to focus its attention on the UK.
Yeah, I think there was this kind of wave of new music also coming out of the UK at the time. America just wasn't really doing anything that was anywhere near as free and experimental. I mean, they had Our Daughter's Wedding, and that was about it. So I think a really important part of that, I think, was Paul and Michael Berrow. Paul, in particular,
the managers who managed you.
Yeah, he had a real vision, and I think he sort of in the back of his mind wanted to be a film director at that point, which he sort of or a film producer. Which,
well, they
he
did, didn't they? They went on.
Doing.
But
and that was the beginning of it. And he went traveling. He went to went to Machu Picchu and went to Sri Lanka, and he was on boats and things, and that you can really trace the sort of the locations of a lot of those videos back to him. So it's definitely the Sri Lankan video, definitely the Antigua, Rio, and
didn't you all happen to be on holiday in Antigua at the time? Wasn't
well, it was no, it, was, it didn't quite work out like that. I think that's one version of it. I know that we were on our way from. We finished the album, the Rio album, in London. Nick stayed on to mix it with Colin. We flew to Sri Lanka to shoot the videos there. Nick joined us, and we shot. That's the story of Nick turning up in Colombo Airport wearing a blue.
Oh yeah,
a blue leather suit. sort of Weimar Republic sort of suit. Was it Wehrmacht? But that's the kind of thing that you can't talk about now. And we did the videos there, and something was happening. You could feel there's this excitement, and the video. I remember when we were shooting the stuff for Save a Prayer on the beach down near Gaul, and thinking this is amazing. There's a real feeling. There's something very special. I've never seen anything like this before with music. So from that video shoot, we got on an aeroplane and flew to Australia. By the time we got to Australia, we were world rock stars. Mm-hmm. We'd become massive. Almost, it felt like it was while we were in the air. We landed and we were proper stars in Australia. And we had to, and then we did some shows there, and they were amazing. And then we had to go to America, and they said, "Can you go to America via Antigua, because we need to shoot some more video And we did. We just, we, you know, if they said go to Antigua to shoot video, we went, okay, fine. So we went to Antigua, shot the video, and we stayed on there for the holiday.
And was Russell Mulcahy, the director, was he following you around?
He sort of was. I mean, you know, but it, you know, he was, yeah, he'd done the Vienna, he'd done the video for Vienna for Ultravox before us. There's a band.
He worked with us. We did. He did Muscle Bound with us. He did a few videos for us.
Right, and he suddenly became a very, very important part of not just our setup, but I think you know, one of the most important video directors in the world at that time. You know,
he was the Spielberg, wasn't he, of that world?
As video exploded with MTV, and as you exploded, as we exploded, so did Russell.
I think what those videos, those international flavoured videos, you know, exotic places that you were travelling to, what they expressed to everyone was that you were a global band. They were they were sending postcards from the front back home.
And the front was beautiful. Yeah, you know,
so there was aspirational.
In the same way as sort of a generation before, it would have been James Bond films that did that showed people these, you know, exotic.
Yeah. And of course, you know, that was our medium of communication. Mm-hmm. You know, that said something about our lifestyle. In the same way bands now have to be on TikTok to show whatever they're doing at any given time, you could still, you know, retain mystique and be in these wonderful places. But I think there was something else where your music seemed to match the visuals too. Because that album, you know, that
album. You're talking about Rio.
An exotic Rio. He had an exotic feel to it.
Yeah, you're right. It's called Rio.
It had
Rio.
The best qualities. <You know. laughs> yeah, but it had the sound of it. Where it had a lushness to it at times. You know, I mean, that particular song, "Save a Prayer," and you know, that was akin to the later part of Roxy Music style.
Yes, which, sort of the Avalon kind of stuff. I think you're right. I think we wanted. Well, John came up with the title Rio. I think he was thinking. He was sort of. He's looking at Roxy's Fiesta and thinking, what's like that? And he's like, Carnival? No, not quite. It's a bit fairground, isn't it?
And Fate.
Rio. And he's the one who said, I think we should have a song called Rio. I went, yep, I think I can write that. And we took an existing song, which is at the time called Amy A Go-Go, and just...
Amy A Go-Go.
No, we never had that. That was my vocal melody. That was my vocal melody. I came up with that. The only thing was just the backing was there, but the melody I came up with.
But these are all these songs that you had already had half written whilst you were doing the first album.
Yeah, they were. That's... because we were performing as Amy A Go-Go. I think it went, oh lace, oh lo say me, oh la so la. Was it? Can't remember. How's that go again? That's do re mi fa. It went fa so la ti do a mi a go go. It's a bit like that. I kind of picked it up, and I thought I always thought it was a bit crap. And then
it's going to make you a fortune in the end.
It became Rio. I was watching this. I was in Birmingham. I went to a little cafe, and I was watching this very, very. I couldn't take my eyes off the waitress who was there, the way she was moving around the floor, and that's where the lyric comes from. Moving on the floor now, baby, you're a bird of paradise. And it was this waitress in a Birmingham cafe. You probably talk like this. And if she did, I'd have loved her.
How was the writing process, Simon? How was the writing process in the band? How does it ever develop? Because you've never sort of said, "Oh, this is written by
no,
Nick."
No, well,
or this
nothing
is written by
really
you,
is. I mean, we.
How is it? How is the process?
There's an absolute an equality in the band. There's no band leader in Duran Duran. I mean, you know, Nick wants he wants to look after. Nick and John like to look after the art side of things. You know, I do a lot of the kind of the stuff that involves words, but there's no clear leader, and that means that everybody's involved at the writing level, and everybody participates financially as well, and so we go in the room, and one of the rules, which is that you don't go in with any preconceived ideas, you go with a really empty head, which can mean that things take time to start going. But when they do get going, you're really open to the inspiration, and you get really, I think you get very inspired writing that way.
Yeah, but what if someone does have a preconceived idea?
You've just got to slip it in quietly. Yeah, yeah. You know?
Oh, look what I've just thought of.
Bishop said to the choir boy.
Oh, no, I wanted to, because this choir boy thing, by the way, you mentioned, because I saw an old documentary of you where you go back and you went and saw your old choir master.
Oh, right, yes.
And he played a recording of when you were in the choir. Yeah. And you were so hard on yourself. It's unbelievable. It's like it's from a show. Oh, no.
Oh, it's funny,
there.
No.
I was thinking, give yourself a break.
Oh, was that one bit? And at the end of it, I was going, yeah, running out of breath.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, pushing that. Oh, there it goes.
It's like you're your nightmare dad.
Yeah, but it was very liberating to be able to say that in front of him. He was my choir master and gracious critic, and I was kind of saying, yeah, I know how you would have heard that then. I know how you would have listened to it, and I know what you've picked up on. He's such a wonderful person, Michael Turvey. I think he's an MBE. Michael Turvey, MBE. He's done so much for not just teaching kids how to sing, but so much for the church, so much for the community. He's an absolutely wonderful man.
Rio's so massive, and you're enormous. You're the new Beatles in America. You know, everything has come your way. I think the hardest time to go and write is when you've achieved everything you need to achieve, and you've got to just keep the status quo. Yeah. That's the most difficult period in any band's career.
I know what you mean. I think we
do. You remember that?
What we do is we close off all of that other stuff. We close off to the you know, so-called success. We close off to all kind of ideas of celebrity and fame and what all that means. And we just go back to music and lyrics.
Mm. But you did have quite a hard time on the next one, didn't you? That was Seven and the Ragged Tiger, wasn't
Yeah,
it?
But I mean, the thing about us is that music comes to us very easily. Mm-mm. You know, music, harmonic structures and melody, which is kind of my bit of it, that comes very easy. Words always take mm-hmm. longer. And since Seven and a Ragged Tiger, that has always been the case, right up until the last album. But this one, we had the indulgence of lockdown, of a year of you know, pandemic, for me to get my ducks in a row and actually get some decent words written down. Michael Hutchence always used to say to me, "If you get writer's block," he says, "What I do." I'm not going to try and do his accent. He says, "What I do is I just write anything that comes into my head, any old rubbish, any old crap. And if you carry on long enough, it starts to get good." And actually, there's something in that. There's something in the idea that you've got to get the stuff that you've got in the front of your mind, that you've got to get it out before the better stuff has a chance to get through. Because it's blocked.
Something like a pomegranate. You know, the writing stuff you saw on Get Back when was it Lennon suggests to George Harrison something like a pomegranate?
Yes.
Remember, that's absolutely true. You know, I think it's called The Artist's Way. There's a great book.
Somebody else was telling me about this the other day, and I said, I do that too.
It's a stream of consciousness.
Well, I think of how you
writing.
Should write every morning when you first get up, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. To get the crap out, throw it away.
For me, writing lyrics is always, I know I have to work a little bit longer than I really want to. So, because at the beginning it is all front brain consciousness, and then to get into that, the best stuff, you've got to really work through all that that before it starts to come out. Have you ever though taken what you see as a fully written lyric into the band and said, look, I'd really like to try and work with this idea lyrically?
I've taken fully written songs into the band. I took right. Nightboat in. I took The Chauffeur in. But then they always get changed anyway, which is fair enough.
Is that by the band or by you? I was just wondering, singers' lyrics are essentially your department. Do you have sort of a veto on that? Or
On lyrics, yeah. Yes, because it's my mouth that they yeah. have to come out of right, when ultimately right. when we're recording and when we're on stage, more importantly. So I do say I can't see if there's somebody else comes up with words, which they don't all that much, to be honest with you. But Nick and John do have ideas lyrically, and sometimes they're something I'll be going, nah, I don't think so. But other times I go, wow, that's great. I like that. That's different. I'd have never come up with that idea myself. And that's what's nice. I don't rewrite much poetry. I do write little phrases and things, but I'm always thinking of songs. So it's I'm more likely to come in with a riff and a lyric than just a lyric on its own.
Right. Let's talk about that period when you kind of all did your own thing right. for a bit, which I remember at the time thinking, what the fuck? Yeah. You know, they're in Duran Duran. Why do they want to be in Arcadia in the Power Station?
Well, it was Power Station started first. You know, and I think that had a lot to do with, that was very much, I think, Andy, his rock aspirations. And I think he and John was willing to go along with that with him. But I'm lazy, and I thought, I'll have a year off. I think I'll go and sail around the world. And then I got a call from Nick saying we can't let them do this and not do anything ourselves. We'll have to do something, Charlie. I went, okay, all right then. So we went to Paris. Oh, we had a great time in Paris.
Well, and you had again, you called in some great. Musicians.
I know, extraordinary. I mean, Grace really? Jones, Herbie Hancock.
Yeah, I mean,
Dave Gilmour.
A somewhat underused David Gilmour, I would have said on that.
What do you mean? On that record?
Yeah.
We only had him for a short while, and everything he played, we used.
Oh, okay.
We didn't have him for the whole album.
He's on for like one or two songs, but even then.
Mark Egan on bass.
Yeah.
I mean, that was extraordinary. He just come.
And whose call was that? Who?
That was Alex. Alex Sadkin.
Oh, of course.
Because Alex was the producer. Phil Thornley came to begin with. He lasted 1 week, and he saw how things were going and how we were doing writing and recording. And he just disappeared one night, and it was like a Friday night, and he didn't come into the studio on Saturday. And then he'd left a note for Alex saying, I can see where this is going. It's not my cup of tea. I'm off. Or the light words. I don't blame him, actually.
Actually, you know what?
It was a long process, that one. But I also loved that. I loved the Power Station album as well. I really enjoyed listening to that. That's got some fantastic.
Do you think, looking back though, that you should have ploughed on and made the next Duran album?
Because I think we would have fallen out in a different way had that been the case. There was all kinds of pressure on the band. There was pressure from the industry around us that was all kind of that we were kind of the cash cow in a way. Although I mean I'm not saying that they only survived because of us, but we were the center, we were the hub of merchandising, record industry, a live industry, you know, that was all centered around Duran Duran, and the management and the surrounding industry did not want us to do anything but do Duran Duran, and that put pressure on us. I think it was, in a way, it was us exercising our will not to just do what people wanted us to do and told us to do, you know. And I think, and because there were tensions developing inside of the band, and it was a big break from that, and it was good to do something different, you know.
Well, what's interesting is it's never happened since, and you know you've
no well I think are, you know. Yeah, but you know, so we came back from so we did Power Station and Cadia, and then we got back and we did Notorious, and it wasn't quite as successful as the pre Power Station Arcadia Duran Duran was.
It's yeah,
and then the
lost
next
two
one was
members.
A bit less successful.
You had lost two but, members, which
yeah.
is a big
so
ask.
So it all kind of yeah. it all seemed it, we kind of started a decline, and then we managed to pick it up with the wedding album, An Ordinary World, and Come Undone, and which was such a surprise to us, you know. So this
you became a 90s band.
There was this album. It was huge. It was huge. That whole thing. You were.
I know.
Like,
we
were
made
like,
the
like
album.
You and you. That, so, yeah.
we made the album in Warren's front room in a small house in Battersea, and it was extraordinary. I mean, we've got to talk about Warren a little bit, I think. Andy, everybody knows about Andy, but Warren he is an extraordinary talent, an extraordinary creative talent. He's almost too talented. I mean, I remember what started off with great, great ideas towards the end of our time with Warren ended up with me coming to studio after bunking off for most of the week and Warren going, "Oh, Charlie, we've done the melody. All you have to do is write the words." That really got to me, that did, because that's the hard bit. You mean I can't do the fun bit?
Yeah, exactly. You've had all the fun, yeah.
But he is he's an extraordinary artist. He really is amazing.
Are you still in touch?
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, I don't know if you know, but we've been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I did. Which and that's congratulations.
Which is quite big news. Now, I know that we probably stand a cat's chance in hell of actually getting inducted. But if we did get chosen to be inducted, it would mean going on stage with Warren and Andy.
Of course.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, and you'd probably have to do Ordinary World with Warren and do something else with
Andy. Maybe, but it's a fascinating situation. I hope we do get the induction.
But your relationship with Andy, how is
that? I've always had a good relationship with Andy. Always. I've never.
Because I went to see that Get Back Together. I went to see that Get Back Together show in 2001, 2002.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
When you had that brilliant introduction. Which actually, I think we probably semi-ripped off when we got back together. But where you all came out on stage one by one and stood at the front, just looking, staring at the audience, all five members. And I remember coming and I was filled with that strange mix of euphoria for what was going on and huge envy. But it became the driving force to get me to try and get my band back together again.
I love the fact that the bass, I saw it was Town and Cut, the Forum, wasn't it, when you played there?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, I came to that. Absolutely. It was fantastic. And the bass was so fantastically loud. I just remember thinking, good lad.
Well,
we are
a very bass-driven band, aren't we? Yeah. I mean, I always say that it's the bass which gives me melody lines. The bass has so many harmonics. I hear so many notes when the bass is playing. And that's really what is the first thing that inspires me to come up with melodies, to find that what I call the golden path.
Ah, interesting. Funny enough, because John just recently got a Lifetime Achievement Award from Bass Magazine, and I was asked to say a few words about him, which I was very, very pleased to do.
Oh, nice. So,
yeah. No, John,
us singers,
John,
we don't read Bass Magazine, you know.
Of course you don't. That's why I'm telling you, because for our listeners, because no one reads.
How was it? How did it feel for you, though, to get that five original members back together? Was that hard work to make that happen? Was that a gritty
situation? I think everybody wanted
situation?
It to happen at that time. At the time, me and Nick and John were the kind of drivers of getting it happening. And it was getting Roger and Andy on board was what we saw as being the tricky part. But I think that they were at a stage in their lives where it made complete sense to do it. And it was, you know, they needed it to, you know, me and John and Nick kept Duran Duran in our lives, or kept being in Duran Duran for a long time. And they kind of stopped in the mid 80s. So 15 years, we kind of got used to it, but they hadn't had it. And I think if I was him, I would have wanted it very much too.
Because at one point it was just you and Nick, wasn't it?
It went down to me and Nick in 97, yeah.
Duran.
Yeah, exactly. but we hung on. You know, there's never not been a Duran Duran since 1980.
Do you feel, obviously a lot of your audience and a lot of our audience and various pop bands, to use that term, of that period, were female dominated audience. The audience was female dominated.
Yeah. Now the artists are female.
And yeah,
but the front people.
That's right. That's right. But there was that. There is that feeling in music that female fans can be more fickle, and pop fans especially, and can move from you to another band? Or is there that sense? I say there's two questions here. One, is there the sense that these guys have always been there to support you and are still there? Has your audience grown at all? But also, how did you feel? Was there ever that moment thinking, I just want to be taken seriously as a musical band and not just as pretty kids?
I think as a band, we used to come out of a show go, oh, most guys yet, you know.
All right.
And then that changed. And then so now we go on and it's like most girls yet now. Because where it used to be girls that followed us, it's sort of over the years you find the guys have come out of their from under the shadow of the girls, and they're the ones who sort of follow us now.
I actually there's a quote I remember of Nick's from like back in the mid 80s, and it was someone leveling the accusation of being a teeny bop band, and right. Nick said something brilliant. He just said, little girls are cool, little girls discovered the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah. The men don't know, so, but yeah, the little girls understand.
Because I think that's what the balance in the band is, has always been, so why it's been so successful is because you've got the, you know, I love Nick, you know, he's a great friend, yeah, of mine, but the absolute, yeah, artiness of Nick,
yeah,
and what he brings to the party, people from Japan that you've never heard of, you know, and then you, John, you know, John is, it's always been,
hang
know,
on, I brought Chai to the new album, that was me.
Well, we were talking about that earlier, Guy and I, about how about your collabs on this album,
how all new artists have sort of these mad names.
Collabs that I had, yeah, it's like that. No one has normal names anymore. They're not called. No. And it goes to featuring
Tool of the Law,
featuring, yeah, John. You know, it's.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, Tool of the Law.
Tool of the Law. I mean, she's amazing. Well, she's a big star.
Ivorian Doll.
Ivorian Doll is. Ivorian Doll. She. I mean, her and Chai are two artists that I'd come across in my work for the radio show, actually. And they are incredible. I mean, Chai, the energy that they brought to that song that saved it from going in the bin. Kind of likewise, Ivorian Doll, actually. You know, Hammerhead was heading into the bin, I think, before she got on it.
So how does it work? Do you make the call and they come in and then you say, what tracks do you like? Or we've got this one in mind? Or?
Well, they were all a bit different, really. The one with More Joy. Well, More Joy and Hammerhead, we approached the artists, both Chai and Ivorian Doll, with that song and said, we'd like you to do something on this song. Whereas Tool of the Law, that was a completely different situation, because it was that somebody sent a list of artists who Duran Duran ought to collaborate with to the management, and management sent it to us, and it's a great long list, and it was a bit stupid actually, because it had things like Justin Bieber and what's her name, Taylor Swift at the top. We thought, yeah, sure. Adele, yeah, right.
And can you get Brad Pitt in the video?
And exactly, you know, yeah. And sort of down the list, we saw Tool of the Law, and John and I both went, oh, we've seen her, because we actually stood side stage and watched her at Lollapalooza in Sao Paulo when we did that festival. And we said, well, at least we know who she is, and she's actually pretty good, we've got a connection there. So we actually decided to send something to her, and the record company, in their wisdom, or management in their wisdom, sent the entire demo album, every song, all of the music, and it was like, oh no. I found out that I thought that's the wrong way to do it. And of course, and she came back with she wanted to be on Give It All Up, which I thought was finished. I thought, no, I've done it's me, I've done that, I don't want to share the vocal on that with anybody. And then Nick said, well, do you think you can just kind of convince her to sing on something else? I said, no, if she's made her mind up that she wants to sing on that song, there's no way we're going to change her mind. She's just going to say, oh, well, I won't do it then. So I said, let's just see what she does when she sends, not what she can do on the demo. Let's see if we like it. And she sent back this demo. It was fantastic. And I realized at that point that I'd have to write another verse for me to sing on. It was brilliant.
Because I guess you did it remotely.
We did everything remotely except for obviously Graham, who's in the room writing with us, and Ivorian Doll, who lives in she lives up City Road, I think.
Oh, you've ruined it now. I mean, sorry. Seriously, Ivorian Doll should have come from
the Ivory Coast.
Well, she does. I mean, I think her family is from the Ivory Coast. Her family's from the Ivory Coast, but if you listen to her, she's all. I'm leaking from my SDDs and stuff like that. She's very funny. Her lyrics are very funny. And she's very London. And that's what I wanted. I wanted that kind of, you know, what they call multicultural London. Mm-hmm. But really, it's like modern London rap. And I wanted that on the record. I wanted that sound. And I thought it would really benefit that song in particular.
Sorry, guy.
No, you go. I was just going to say, what next?
We all seem to be, everyone seems to be very into doing featured artists now. Is it a thing that keeps you in feeling contemporaneous?
Not particularly. Well, contemporaneous because we've got collaborations on the record.
With younger artists.
But interestingly, this is a feature of music generally. If you look at the top 20, all the records are this, featuring this, featuring. Yeah.
And it spreads to social media.
Well, I think that's the kind of, it's trying to double the power of your social media and your pull, really, your appeal. And that's the way that the industry thinks about it. But of course, we think about what's going to make a song sound good. Mm-hmm. All right, we've got to do a collaboration. But then as soon as you find the right one, and if you put enough time in, you just don't go for somebody because they've got a big name or they've got the right name, and actually help them do it as well, which we did with all of them, then you end up with something that you're invested in, and you think, wow, that is great. It's better than we could have done on our own.
And what you haven't done is go down that sort of route of being pushed out to Sweden to meet Max Martin and get him to write the album for you.
Right, yes.
You know, still a writing force.
I mean, you know that's not going to happen with us, but we love the writing stage. That's the purest, but also the most satisfying part of the job. When you come up with that melody or that phrase, that lyric that really does it perfectly, you think, oh God, I love that feeling. I mean, you know, when you listen back to the demo and the hairs come up on the back of your neck, it's an incredible feeling, and only music does it. Only music can inspire this sort of passion in me, for sure. I love it. I've always loved it, and I feel so lucky to still have it this far in.
Simon, this is absolute perfect time to end as well. And thank you, and congratulations on the new album. You know, last time I saw you was at Pete Tong's award event.
Yes.
And you were very nervous because you wanted your album to do well. And I think the day after it went in at number three. And I thought about you when I saw that chart position and how thrilled you must have been. And congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. You. I'll vote for you. Don't worry.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Oh, thank you very much, Simon.
One last question. Where does Whoosh come from?
It's the sound. Well, it started off as the sound of the receiver heading towards the cradle. So whoosh, bang, brrr. But it became, for me, it became the sound of your mind expanding to take on a new idea.
Because I've got lovely texts from you on my phone. Yes, you always put whoosh at the end.
So, it's my sign-off. It's my tag. All righty. Thanks for chatting. Lovely to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely way to wrap it up.
That is indeed a lovely way to wrap it up. And what a lovely chat that was. And what nice things he said at the end.
Yeah, he's such a generous man, isn't he now?
Yeah.
Very, very mature. It was so nice having his version of events, walking into that room with his book of lyrics, you know. And if you, as I said earlier, if you look back, you can listen to John telling you his side of the story on one of our earlier podcasts.
Yeah.
And of course, I forgot to mention we had Lowell Creme on, who, you know.
Of course.
Lowell Cream?
Lowell Cream.
Why do I say creme? I'm obviously.
Sounds like it should be creme when it's on its own, but then godly and creme doesn't work, does it?
It doesn't. What about Pratt and Kev? Does that work?
Pratt and few things work, I say.
Of course we work. Of course it works. Yes. It works brilliantly. And long may it continue.
Well, indeed. Oh, my God, so that was the most radio presentery thing you've ever said. I really just the way you said it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it must be I've got my 80s head on. This is my Peter Powell head. You could be Simon Bates.
I'm good, thanks.
Right. So, until next week.
All right, pop pickers.
It's good night from me.
And it's good night from all of us.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.